State of the Empire is presented by the Nerdy Show Podcast Network, geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse, and is brought to you in part by Consequence of Sound, the web's foremost source of music and film news, reviews, and insights. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination, and with the generous support of listeners like you. To learn how you can support this and other fine geek programming, visit nerdyshow.com.
Welcome to State of the Empire, Nerdy Show's Star Wars speculation podcast, where we look for news in Alderaan places. Hi, I'm Cap.
Hi, I'm Doug.
Hey, I'm Matt.
And in this episode, well, this is the episode right before the release of Rogue One.
Woo!
Oh, man, it's been a long time leading up to this, and we're all pretty fucked up with excitement, I think.
Well, there's been lots of ups and downs. I remember, like, when we saw the first teaser at Celebration, it was like, oh my gosh, this is the coolest thing ever. And then a whole lot of nothing after that. And it's like, oh, why are they not showing enough stuff? And then they show a little bit more stuff. And you're like, oh, this is looking pretty good. This looks really nice. First teaser, official teaser. And then you see that they're doing some reshoots. And you're like, oh, no. And you start to really think maybe there's something wrong happening. But then you don't hear anything for a while. But then you get another official trailer. You're like, oh, my God, it looks amazing again. And then you're saying, okay, well, this is mostly the same stuff. You get an international trailer. So it's... We've been run through the ringer, and but based on some of the new stuff we're seeing, I think we're about to talk about now some new clips and stuff.
I mean, at this point, we've absorbed so many clips for this film.
I feel like we've already seen 10 minutes of it.
Yeah,
we've gotten like a year's worth of marketing in the last like 72 hours.
Yeah,
that's true. So in addition to talking about Rogue One and what we know about the film going into it, we're also going to be talking about new rumors revolving around Episode 8, parental lineages, the crazy happenings of Star Wars Rebels and their mid-season break, some cool book stuff, and if this is your first time here, don't worry, because if it's super sensitive and we think it might ruin your film-going experience, we're putting it behind the blast doors. That's a thing that happens later on in the show. So you can listen to it from now on to a point where we will clearly denote that we're going to open those blast doors, and then all bets are off. So if you stick around, that's your own damn fault. All right, so there have been 20-minute-long screenings of Rogue One. There's been full screenings of the film already. George Lucas has seen the film. He called up Gareth Edwards and said, "Hey, pal, I think this is really great." Which he didn't say about Force Awakens necessarily.
Yeah. Well, at least he didn't say that publicly afterwards.
Yeah.
I think George is a smart guy, and he wouldn't be he wouldn't be the kind of guy that just goes, "Oh yeah, you know, it was pretty good, you know, pretty good, I guess."
Say, well, they're white slavers, so
pretty good for white slavers. I mean, like, well, after Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, Shia got into some hot water with Steven Spielberg when he was like, "Oh man, Steven kind of dropped, you know, we all kind of dropped the ball on that." And Steven Spielberg later came out and said, "You know, there's a time to sell movies and there's a time to sell cars, you know."
And if anybody should know how to sell some cars, it's Shia LaBeouf. He was in Transformers.
Yeah, I wonder if that was a backhanded compliment about having to sell cars. I want to believe that George actually liked it. I mean, George, we all know, is a big fan of the World War II action films. And this very much plays into that.
I mean, really, if anything, Gareth was playing to George in this case. Since our last episode, about a month ago, and we're sorry it's been so long. This is a busy time of year. We've seen flashback sequences. We've seen an incredible X-Wing dogfight in the orbit of Scarif. We've seen fighting on the streets of Jeddah. We've seen the Death Star devastate Jeddah. That was just... I think we might have put that behind the spoiler wall last time, but surprise, surprise, that's
in the trailers.
It's
now.
In every trailer now, and it's terrifying.
Yeah, I'm just going in with the assumption that every single one of these planets is blowing up in this movie at this point. It's just safe to assume.
And at this point, we've also seen so many trailers, it's really hard to recommend just one to check out if you haven't been following all of them. But I would say international trailer number 4 is a pretty hot item, so I'm going to be linking that on this episode's page.
Yeah.
It's crazy the amount of, they're up to 30 TV spots. I remember, because like the prequel TV marketing, they did very specific like character campaigns that like sometimes had unique dialogue, and like they only would do like 4. And like they would just run those all the time. And like Disney's approach for Rogue One has been so far to date 30 different cuts of TV spots, which is insane.
Yeah. And fortunately for State of the Empire, These different cuts have shown us a lot of weird stuff that we can pick out of the background.
Yeah, and I almost wish it was less.
Oh, I absolutely wish it was less. Those character spots for the prequels were like some of the best stuff from the prequels.
Yeah, they were like tone poems.
Yep.
And you know, George and his poems.
It's like poetry. You know, rhyme.
And now, in the last month, we've also gotten two different 360, not necessarily VR, but could be VR experiences. They're VR if you want them to be, including one that might be canonical to the film, like a scene. We'll link to it. It's a video of an X-Wing squadron accidentally happening upon the first Death Star while it's in construction. This is the first the Rebels have experienced it at all. And you basically, from a first-person perspective, watch your team get annihilated and then you die.
The Battlefront VR mission may also be canonical.
Oh, yeah. Matt, I mean, this is... We're going to talk about video games a little bit later, but you've done this. Why don't you tell us about it right now? Because I want to hear all about it.
So you play a brand new X-Wing pilot who's piloting Red 4, and they're kind of like, you know, you're with the fleet, and they're kind of, you know, just doing a patrol and, you know, bickering with one another as Rebels typically do over the comm. And then eventually you get a distress call from, basically it's K2SO sending in a distress call from whatever planet that they're liberating a person of interest from, which I assume is Jyn Erso, because they keep referring to she or her. And so you go to hyperspace to go, you know, help the ship out. And there's, you know, it's kind of in an asteroid field, and you find the U-Wing in the asteroid field, and then the Empire shows up, and you gotta, like, you know, defend the U-Wing while they make their hyperspace coordinates. And K2, it's not Alan Tudyk's voice, but it's very funny. And you know, eventually you escape, but they keep on, you know, they keep mentioning like, oh, I hope she's worth it. I hope, you know, so it's apparent to me, this kind of takes place in between like what appears to be the liberation of Jyn from prison in the beginning of the movie that they've shown in some of the trailers and actually getting her to the Rebel fleet. I don't think you'll see this in the movie, but there's the canonical possibility that they ran into some trouble with a Star Destroyer on the way out of that planet.
Cool. And yeah. How was the VR? Was it quality?
Oh, it's awesome. I mean, it's just I wish they hadn't have used Battlefront's controls, because they're not very in depth. Like, I would rather have had a version where you use the PlayStation Move controllers, which, you know, they try to encourage developers to use, because, you know, you have actual like tracking your hand movements instead of just having a controller in front of you. But, you know, and like be able to actually like use one like a joystick, use the other one to actually like, you know, press a button to activate your shields on the controls. So unfortunately, it's just a lot of, you know, you're in the X-Wing cockpit and you're using the normal Battlefront controls. But there really is a very special feeling when all of a sudden you hear something like above you and you look up, you know, through your canopy and you see a giant Imperial Star Destroyer has just hyperspaced in above you and is deploying TIE fighters as they're, you know, things are going on. Like, it's very cool.
That's awesome.
So, Spill, was this like on rails in any way, or do you actually free fly?
It's the standard space or standard flight mode mm-hmm. that it normally has. You just are now controlling it from a first person perspective in a cockpit. Nice. So you're holding the PlayStation controller, flying it like normal, and you're just in the cockpit.
They don't have any joystick compatibility by any chance?
No, because it's just PlayStation. Bruh. So that's what I mean. Like, if they had the controls changed so that you were using the Move controllers, you probably could have some sort of joystick type situation going on.
But with a Move, you could like literally move your hand behind your head and it wouldn't track it right. Like, you know, like you have too much freedom with a move controller.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there might need to be some sort of like accessory to like, you know, keep it in place, essentially make it a joystick, mm-hmm. I suppose.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, I mean, there's limitations to every VR headset that's come out so far as controllers are concerned. But I think it was pretty effective overall, though, and makes me really excited about the possibilities in the future. Like, I want a full, like, real in-depth flight sim in VR, specifically Star Wars.
That'd be cool as hell.
Mm-hmm. Bring back X-Wing versus TIE Fighter.
Exactly.
Yeah, like, after many failed attempts to do so, it would be good if they just fucking did it.
Mm-hmm.
The other 360-degree experience was showcasing the immersive sets used in the film, particularly the Jedha battle sequences. And it is actually really impressive. Like, they didn't, you know, so many times you'll see on a set, well, you build the front of the set and the rest of it isn't there. But this is really, they built the whole damn thing. And there's a lot of detail. There's a lot of stuff that's just never, ever going to show up in the final edit of the film.
Which actually kind of makes me, from a filmmaking perspective, a little worried about the movie, especially some of the clips we've seen where the editing seemed very hectic. And I feel that's just because they don't really have an idea going in. They're like, just film like from 3-4 different locations. And they even said, like, you get to pick up on things that you wouldn't like have planned for. And then just when they piece them together, it just doesn't seem very fluid so far in like the battle clips that are, you know, more ground based.
In the trailer, but, you mean?
Yeah, like, some of the clips, like, for instance, the one that I want to say debuted on Fallon with Jin fighting off the stormtroopers, the editing is just all over the place. Like, very hard for me to figure out, like, where exactly Cassian Andor is in relation to Jin. And, like, and I think it's because they're filming from so many different places, so fluidly, like, that they're just kind of like, well, we'll edit it later. We're not going to worry about like how this is going to play out shot wise.
I'm not convinced that these full scenes that we've seen are actually full scenes.
Yeah,
which I've contemplated as well, but it makes me wonder because, you know, the music seems to match up, which is why I wonder if it is.
Fair point.
You know, I guess maybe, but just until we see it, we don't know. This could have been something that was even done just for...
Well, and also, you know, Gareth Edwards in that EW thing about the Jedha sequence. I mean, he even said it. He said, you know, we have camera people, you know, running around throughout the scene, and they're picking up things that the extras wouldn't, you know, they didn't necessarily plan on. So, like, it's just, it's very, we'll figure it out in post how it'll be edited. And I think it's a weird, like, it's an approach to filmmaking that is more common nowadays that I don't particularly care for.
Well, a thing I don't particularly care for is that they gave Jin a baton to fight stormtroopers. Like, I guess the idea is that she doesn't have a weapon. You know,
they showed a scene where she steals a blaster,
right?
And,
but they gave
it to her.
But I don't get how it. You're fighting stormtroopers.
It's a toy to sell.
Yeah, it's a toy to sell.
It's Rey's staff. It's, you know, it's her thing.
Just give her a gun. You know, like, why the fuck does she have? Because it has to be non-lethal because they're the good guys.
Because gun toy sales are understandably taboo these days. It's hard to, you know.
Oh, it's just so dumb. Just the idea of just stormtroopers. There's like 5 stormtroopers down a hallway. First of all, none of them can hit her. But then she just comes out without a gun and just walks up to them close. She's close enough to touch them and they can't shoot her. That's the thing. That's the only thing I didn't really care for. It was an exciting sequence. You know, I like the music.
Yeah, but
she's walking up to a stormtrooper and beating him over the head. He has a helmet on, like, and she's able to beat him over the head, and it hurts him that he falls over unconscious. I don't get it. Unless there's, like, electricity somehow involved in the baton. I don't know.
But, all valid points. And I should add, you know, you're going to hear from us real soon in... less than a week, you're going to hear from us again. Our post-film review will be out basically as soon as possible. We got a East Coast and a West Coast team here, and that means that it's super difficult to sync up. Last time we did it at, 3 a.m. Eastern, and we vowed never again.
Yeah.
So it's going to be Friday morning instead or something. Sometime, I guess, Dougie got work, so yeah, Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
Which means...
Which I think that Friday afternoon is when I'm seeing the movie a second time.
So we gotta figure this out. So maybe check back with us on Saturday. We should have something by Saturday.
Yeah, for sure.
And maybe next time we'll figure out how to be all in the same place. But that's a little bit expensive. So, you know, help fund State of the Empire on Patreon, and maybe we can talk about that. Or if you want to give us a donation because you love State of the Empire so much, hey, we can talk about that too. You'll find everything you need at nerdyshow.com/support. This is an unplanned plug, but why not? Maybe you're filthy rich and maybe you want to hear us talk about Star Wars. Maybe you want us to go see the movie with you and want to pay for all of us to be where you are. Okay.
Hey, man, that sounds like fun.
So here's some things we do know about Rogue One. And this is an interesting checklist because it's not one I necessarily expected to be doing. Characters to watch out for. in the background. We have no idea how much screen time any of this stuff is going to get, but we've seen enough to indicate there's going to be either some cool background characters that are new or some characters that you know that are there. For starters, Rex, who you might remember from intermittent episodes of State of the Empire, who's always with us when we do our film reviews, he spotted in a trailer the Ghost from Star Wars Rebels in a big multi-ship assault of Scarif.
And I, by the way, they've been pronouncing it Scarif on the DLC for Battlefront.
Okay, then. Scarif.
Yep, didn't expect that.
Well, yeah, so it's we've got a screenshot we can show you, but I mean, like, it's, when else have you seen that ship type anywhere? It's mm-hmm. There's no one else it could be. Are we going to hear characters, you know, talking chatter from Rebels?
Yeah, like if they're getting into attack formation, you hear like Red 2 standing by, Red 3 standing by, Red 4 standing by. You hear Hera go, Ghost 1 standing by. You know, just like, that'd be like so fucking cool just to get this voice actor in there.
I was actually thinking, like, would it be crazier to see some actual live action actors standing around the conference table that all the Rebels are around?
I'd just be a quick peek at
Freddie Prinze Jr. looking like Kanan.
That would be cool, but I'd be really surprised if they just went full out.
I mean, I'd be shocked too, but it would be awesome.
It would be awesome. It would indeed be awesome. I
think Freddie Prinze would probably do that for free.
I'm sure that SAG wouldn't let him, but
no, yeah.
I'm sure that he would.
He'd be willing to. He's cool.
There's a new character called Admiral Raddus, who's a darker-hued Mon Cal, who you've probably seen in some of the shots. And interestingly, they modeled him after Winston Churchill in both look and performance. And the designers also admitted to taking inspiration from Bela Lugosi, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Ernest Borgnine, Lee Van Cleef, and Peter Lorre, but didn't say who was who in so far as the creature design specifically. Mm. And I don't know that we've seen any of those characters, so some new faces to keep an eye out for. There's a charity video that was made on the set of Rogue One for Assert, which is a group helping people with Angelman syndrome. We'll link to the video where you can check it out and learn more about that disorder and the charity. But in that video, there's some revealing shots that suggest that we might be seeing Biggs Darklighter and Jack Porkins at least amongst the original Death Star killer squadron, which is pretty cool. If they're there, maybe Wedge is there too.
Hmm.
And also in this video were some pans over some hand-carved starships and droids, which it's assumed might be young Jin's toys from the flashback. Which, if so, they're kind of neat and an interesting background detail. I can't imagine it'll be focused on, probably, mm-hmm. but another cool thing to look out for in the background. Now, here's something that could be complete bullshit. It comes from a site that I have no experience with whatsoever. It's called Furious Fanboys, and they've heard from a source that there's two Gungans on set during the briefing scene at the Rebel base.
I'd be really surprised.
One of them.
I wouldn't. I'm hoping for it.
What would Gareth want on the set? Would he want two Gungans?
I think he'd be okay with it. He might. He doesn't seem like a.
Well, now the question is: is it two random Gungans?
No,
but that's the thing.
One of them is apparently Maybe. Looks a lot like Jar Jar.
Yeah.
And here's some other thing. Like this maybe substantiates the presence of these Gungans, if in fact. This is a real thing. It was also rumored that Oliver Ford Davies, who played the Naboo governor, Siu Bibble, was on set for one day and was with these Gungans. They don't believe there's any lines, but they could be there in a shot, creating the implication of what's long been discussed in the expanded universe circles about Jar Jar, the fact that he was responsible for putting Palpatine in charge, and the fact that he might feel fucking awful about that. Now, I don't want prequel stuff cluttering up the stories and so on, but I do want Star Wars to work and be cohesive. So, like it or not, the prequels are there, and much like Saw Gerrera's inclusion in this film, you know, it's good to have a living, working universe, and Jar Jar Binks, a prominent character in the series, catastrophically fucked up, and we don't know what happened to him. So, sooner or later, that story is going to come out, and maybe the start of it is here. And then,
just bring it on. I mean, I love it. I love like well thought out prequel connective tissue to like make this a transition movie, and that's.
I always need more ammo for my. For my Jar Jar better than Chewie, like.
Well, right there, you can go ahead and say that he joined the rebellion before Chewie.
Yeah.
Chewie was enslaved and he didn't even join the rebellion.
Yeah. Became a drug dealer, or at least working for one.
There's one other character, that is probably pretty major in the film, at least in a couple scenes, and we've discussed this character's appearance in Rogue One before, but because of the closeness to the film's release, because this could be considered a spoiler at this juncture, we're going to talk about that behind the spoiler wall. But basically, there was a recent Anthony Bresnikan article on Entertainment Weekly that basically it more or less confirmed something that we said months and months and months ago about a certain technological advancement that would allow for a certain character to be in this film. Now, the movie might not have any opening titles, but something interesting we have learned is that when it cuts to a new planet, it does tell you where you are in the bottom right corner of the screen, which is another thing to watch out for. And Scarif, we got some new details on Scarif, and that is that it's Krennic's main base of operations, actually, which I didn't realize. It's a major hub for the Empire's military-industrial complex, and it's a top-level site for research, structural engineering, munitions, and manufacturing, which is why it's not just that Death Star plans. It's like a major operations center, and that's why the entire planet is surrounded by a shield.
Mm-hmm.
That's a weird environment to be in, that, like, you know, primarily water with like some islands dotted around. Like, it's basically an entire planet that's like the Maldives. Like, I don't know. That seems weird.
Well, it could be if they're mining something out of the water there, you know.
Maybe.
It's unique to the planet or type of metal or something that's under the surface.
That's true. It's a good point. It's a good point indeed. Now, on the Star Wars Spoilers Facebook group, a little side operation we run, Stephen Peckham pointed out a Pablo Hidalgo tweet featuring a screenshot of the Death Star meeting room scene from A New Hope, saying an important scene worth a rewatch in the coming weeks for several reasons. And Stephen said, "Trixie Pablo, I just noticed there's an empty chair there. Is it Krennic's? Also, this makes me wonder if it's Tag's fleet that's at Scarif during the Rebel attack." Which could be all very cool.
Yeah.
Like, I do fully expect to watch this film and come home and want to watch A New Hope immediately afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the lines from there, it's like, the Rebellion's, they're more dangerous than you realize. Dangerous to your fleet, Admiral, not this battle station. It's like, ooh, sick burn, you know, like, because of something that may have happened, you know? And
yeah.
I don't know, reading into those lines, it'll be a lot of fun.
It's pretty cool. I think that Steven's dead on there. Now, there's another thing leading to a bunch of new information about Rogue One, and that's the novel Star Wars Catalyst, Matt, which you've read all of.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about that behind the spoiler wall, because that's all real sensitive information.
Yeah.
But we can lift the veil on some interesting stuff, which is that, you know, Lucasfilm's been pretty hush-hush about basically everything ever since the Disney sale. But now that it's been a year since the relaunch, they're loosening up and sharing a bit more on what went on in those first couple years. There was an interview with Kathleen Kennedy in particular that shed light on a lot of stuff. For example, in an interview with Entertainment Weekly, Kathleen Kennedy shared that during one of the first conversations she had with Lucas, he pitched her on the notion of the standalone films and had written down three or four thoughts and ideas of possible directions, which she elaborated on that so far they haven't done any of them.
Mm-hmm.
Young Han Solo is not among those George Lucas ideas. She said, "We talked a lot about the Jedi and the foundational ideas that George had thought about when he crafted the mythology," which is interesting. If they choose to pull from that, maybe George was saying, like, well, maybe you could do, like, some Knights of the Old Republic stuff.
That'd be interesting.
And an Obi-Wan film.
Now, that wouldn't surprise me. But we'll talk about that real soon.
He's like, well, it all started on Willow's planet. Really, George? Oh, yeah, I was supposed to go way back. It's called, you know, Journal of the Wills, as in Willow wrote it. you know.
So we've basically been treating the Boba Fett film as though it was a confirmed thing that was going to happen. Turns out, yeah, we were right in doing that. Kathleen Kennedy owned up to the fact that there was a Boba Fett film that was going to be directed by Josh Trank, and when he pulled out at the last minute, or they pulled him out, or however that happened, no one's really throwing shade exactly in this mm-hmm. situation, publicly anyway. It was going to be revealed at Star Wars Celebration 2014, and
but he air quotes had a cold,
right? Yeah,
and he air quotes wasn't feeling well.
Yeah,
that's why he couldn't be there.
Yeah, but they actually had a teaser made. They made a Boba Fett teaser of some kind. I mean, it was probably all pre-rendered, just like the Rogue One was.
Yeah, but still.
But yeah, but it exists. It existed. It was a thing. It could still be a thing. Mm-hmm. They were ready to do it, which is not exactly surprising, but I was surprised that they actually had a teaser ready for it at that juncture, because mm-hmm. because right now there's been the question of what comes next, and Kennedy has made it sound like they are developing a lot of possibilities, but at this point they're genuinely waiting to gauge the response on Rogue One before making future decisions.
Yeah.
So she actually said, we're planning on sitting down in January, since we'll have had The Force Awakens released and now Rogue One, and we finished shooting Episode 8. We'll have enough information where we can step back a little and say, what are we doing? What do we feel is exciting? And what are some of the things we want to explore? But, you know, had that movie come out, they would have had Rogue One, Boba Fett, and Young Han Solo already announced and or released mm-hmm. at that point. So that's a bit more than... I don't know. It's interesting. I think we're seeing a lot more of the timeline here now. I don't know what she's really, you know, what her level of restraint is, but at the very least, that does definitely apply to what comes after Episode 9. She was asked what happens then. Another trilogy, a cycle of standalones for a while, some kind of new interconnected story maybe. And she said, that's a conversation that's going on right now. I have to honestly tell you, could we do nothing but standalones? Sure. But I don't know. We're looking at all of that. It's interesting. It's an interesting position for them to be in, because, you know, I think they should definitely use numeric trilogy films really sparingly.
Yeah.
Yeah. They ought to all have some sort of visual distinction in like the tech that went, like, I like that, you know, the prequels have their own look together while the original trilogy has theirs, and this new one's going to have theirs, 'cause they're all coming out within, you know, what, 4 years of each other, I guess, in total. And I hope the gap in between 9 and 10, you also have that same feeling. Whether that means 10 is being made in virtual reality, because by that point we all have, you know, permanent VR headsets on our heads, you know, 24 hours a day or whatever. You know, like, they should be different.
It should be to the point where someone says, and we're making Episode 10, and people lose their shit in the biggest way possible because they didn't.
Because they've wanted it for so long.
Well, and they didn't even know for sure it was going to happen.
Right.
Yep.
As for the Obi-Wan film, Bresnikan said an interesting thing on the Rebel Force Radio podcast. He said, I've heard rumors that the one reason they haven't moved sooner on Obi-Wan is that they're not done with Obi-Wan quite yet in the saga films. So I wouldn't be surprised to see an Obi-Wan solo film happen beyond Episode 9. And that's interesting. We've discussed repeatedly on this show what's happening with Rebels concerning Obi-Wan's legacy, what's happening in the Star Wars comics concerning Obi-Wan's legacy, and especially in the comics, how much ground is covered there, mm-hmm. how much they're telling that story in another medium. But certainly they could be seeing the fan response to these rumors that either created spontaneously, much like Shmi Skywalker's birth, or pregnancy, rather. But anyway, or they themselves have seeded these rumors to see what the reaction would be, since mm-hmm. it would be so prequel sensitive.
I haven't heard one person who's like, an Obi-Wan movie starring Ewan McGregor? Like, pretty much everybody has just been like, yeah, no, that would be great, because he was people's favorite part of the entire prequel trilogy.
But would they shoot their own continuity in the foot? And that's what I'm curious about. But maybe they already have it figured out. Maybe they've been...
There's still plenty of empty space there. I mean, he's on Tatooine for,
sure,
you know, 16 goddamn years.
Pablo Hidalgo's downright angry dismissal of Obi-Wan seems more than just deflection.
It does, but it's also weird. I don't know. Like... I'm not even going to try to speculate on his particular stance on the Obi-Wan thing, because it just doesn't seem like the rest of the Lucasfilm family feels that way. Mm.
But what we can speculate on is what Bresnikan meant by Obi-Wan not being done with in the saga just yet. But we'll speculate on that behind the blast doors. As for the Han Solo film, we got the announcement that Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones and Terminator Genesis has been cast. And an interesting change to the sort of copy surrounding the Han Solo film is that the official release announcing her inclusion in it very much stated that it's Han and Chewie's adventures. So really, you know, showcasing them as a team now. Mm-hmm. We're starting to get that in there, which I think is important because, you know, Chewbacca's not a dumb animal. He's a character. He's a beloved character. And it would be nice to give him, like, more of a character.
Yeah.
And the question is, who is she playing? And we don't know that yet. In the past, we talked about actresses who were being looked at for the part, that they were all persons of color, implying perhaps that she might actually be Sana Solo or Sana Staros from the Star Wars comic. And it's still possible that was a consideration. And this might not be a female love interest. This might be a villain. We don't even know. We have no idea what she's playing. It could be
an all CG character for all we know.
It could be that those actors that we did here had been like called back for tests and so on, they could still be in the film.
She's a younger Maz Kanata.
Where's my boyfriend?
Kathleen Kennedy did say something very interesting about the tone of the film in an interview. She said this movie is closer to a heist or Western type feel. We've talked about the famous cowboy painter Frederick Remington and those primary colors that are used in his paintings, defining the look and feel of the film. Very interesting, and makes me more excited for it, because that sounds visually quite compelling.
Hmm. Yep, very much so.
Now on to episode 8. So, let's talk about Snoke. There's, his hologram, it projected quite big. Mm-hmm. Maybe that means he's really, really small.
Yeah.
Or maybe it means he's a human-sized person and he just likes to feel big. Or maybe... Yeah.
Emperor did the same thing.
Maybe he actually is that big.
I know.
Well, according to MakingStarWars.net, who really do most of the time hit it out the park with the details they get leaked, their sources say that Snoke is going to be, in part, a huge puppet. And around 7 to 8 feet tall, that taking several people to operate and a man inside the suit to make him walk.
Now, why go through all the trouble of getting Andy Serkis all covered in dots to give the performance to then literally go to back to being a puppet?
Possibly because of the shitty reviews about how that looked in the film.
Hmm.
The interest from Rian Johnson in probably doubling down on Star Wars' renewed efforts towards animatronics and practical effects.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, and this could be complete bullshit. Someone might have fed them a line, but it's interesting. It's an interesting prospect and certainly a huge challenge for puppeteering that I would love to see someone attempt. But that does mean that if that's true, all the theories revolving around Snoke, who he is, and so on and so forth, well, we'll know him when you see the 7 to 8 foot tall creature.
Mm-hmm. Or they could just always pull a switcheroo like that old Star Trek episode where they land there and literally the puppet they're making is supposed to be a puppet. Like in the Star Wars film itself, in context, it is a giant puppet that he would just like get behind and be like, pay no attention to the Snoke behind the curtain. Like,
maybe so. I don't know.
I don't think it's likely, but I think it'd be interesting if they did.
Bresnikan is a character who's in an interesting situation. You know, he's Lucasfilm's mouthpiece through EW, and from EW he offers Lucasfilm sanctioned press releases, teasers, and even his speculation is most likely 100% sanctioned material. During an interview, he mentioned that Rogue One connects directly to many other films in the franchise, which, of course, is no surprise whatsoever, because obviously it does.
Right.
But he made a point of saying that one of the connecting tethers links to Episode 8. And there's an interesting theory here, which I think we should just address, and then I assume we can unanimously call bullshit on it, so you will have heard our opinion on it. And that is the preposterous, fucking dumb theory that somehow the heroes of Rogue One go on through some conditioning of some kind to become the Knights of Ren.
Yeah.
No.
No way.
Yeah, that's dumb as all hell. in all likelihood, it has something to do with whatever Force lore we pick up on Jedha.
Yeah, I think that's a good bet, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Lor San Tekka, Church of the Force stuff, you know, like, it probably is involved with, you know, Jedha seems, you know, I don't think they go with religious aspects of the Force in two straight movies without the intention of it being some sort of connection in the long run.
Yeah. Moving on to books. We got the Darth Vader comic ended. I don't know if we actually addressed that on the show yet. It had it was an interesting run, but it really felt like Kieran Gillen was just, he's a fantastic writer, but he was not operating at the quality that I normally like get from his works. We did mention Dr. Aphra was getting a solo book. That was a recent announcement. Well, that first issue is out. It's written by Gillen, starring a character who I didn't like at all, and I like this book a lot, at least one issue deep. The art's fantastic. Her character's likable all of a sudden. It's got a funky Star Wars story vibe, whereas Darth Vader felt burdened. Burdened by the fact that it was telling stories about Darth Vader as though you couldn't
tell
all
the stories about Vader, but like weird fucking stories about Vader. Like they just, I don't know. That series is all over the map. A lot of times I just found myself saying, you know, WTF. Like, I didn't know why they were going down this path.
That said, there are some points of note towards the Vader series end, which is why I bring it up again. And that is the second to last issue, which had a bunch of fascinating prequel era flashbacks in Vader's psyche, which is worth checking out. And
that was terrific.
Yeah. Well, Matt, you just read it. You read it far more recently than I did.
Yeah, actually, I finished up the series, the last book this morning, and it's just honestly one of the best like ways to kind of show the psyche transition from Vader of A New Hope, which presumably is the Vader of, you know, the entirety of like the Empire's heyday, into the Vader of Empire and Jedi, which is someone that, you know, while Vader thinks, you know, this obsession with finding Luke is sort of this, he perceives it as like, you know, him going further into the dark side, further, you know, towards accomplishing like the galaxy he wants to see, is actually probably more likely the beginnings of that conflict that Luke talks about, that he senses in Jedi, like basically a return of Anakin Skywalker. So it's actually that issue is great, which was issue 24.
And
in
issue 25
was kind of a slog at times.
Yeah. Issue 25, there's a very strange afterword, which I feel needs to be mentioned. And it's not, I don't deem it a spoiler in the least, which is why I'm going to talk about it here. It is a very strange thing. We see this completely disjointed sequence in which Tusken Raiders build some kind of epitaph of Vader and start worshiping it. It's seemingly unprovoked, except for the fact that Vader loves killing Tusken Raiders, and seemingly always has.
Yeah, and I don't understand the point of making the epitaph like at that juncture of what happened in the Vader comic, as opposed to like when Anakin Skywalker pulled off the same thing in Attack of the Clones. Like, I don't know. Very, I mean, unless it's just this idea that this avenging spirit seems to come here every, you know, 20 years or so to wreak havoc on their society or something. I don't know. It was very odd.
How would they remember? Nice. How would they remember Anakin killing them? Because he killed every single one of them. At least he said so.
Well, that's even this issue says that, you know, same thing with Vader, but it was like, you know, he killed all of them, or did he? And it was basically like one escaped, and tells the tale.
Well, and even then, it's like, all right, a guy came in with a flashy laser sword, killed literally everyone but me, and now we wait and hope that it never shows up again. Then, what, however many years later, another guy with a flashy laser sword shows up, kills everybody. That must be the same guy, you know? So I can understand it if they want to go that route, like the cargo cult sort of thing, you know?
Yeah. I guess the question is, does it mean anything? Why did they end the series on that note? Well, something to watch out for, something to examine, to just know that this scene is out there and that maybe we're supposed to have placed some kind of meaning in it.
And that it concludes the series as opposed to taking, because the actual event takes place after like the first or second issue of Vader, but yeah. They don't tell us about it until the end. Like, I don't know, it's like, it kind of ran counter, I felt, to what was accomplished in issue 24 as far as where Vader's head was at. Obviously, it's not about Vader, but certainly the image that they're trying to present of him.
Yeah, it was very strange.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a fan of the Star Wars art books, then there may have been a recent shakeup. J.W. Rinzler has done all these incredible archival assessments of all the different behind-the-scenes pieces of the making of Star Wars and done all these behind-the-scenes books. Well, he recently tweeted, "I no longer work at Lucasfilm, and I don't know what Skywalker films planned, and again, the Force Awakens book is delayed indefinitely." So that's an interesting piece of drama because he was a major force with Lucasfilm and producing these archival books for them. Like, he had... his work digging through the archives has been extremely important, and one can only imagine what on earth would have separated the two of them.
It's what helped bring some of those outtakes to light for the first time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
like that classic outtake that everyone loves of the Stormtroopers slipping all over themselves, falling through the hole in the door, you know, from A New Hope.
Yeah.
Like
J.W. Risner.
Yeah.
Without him, we wouldn't have that.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I cannot imagine what the hell happened, but... But he's out, and I don't know if anybody's filling that void or not.
Hmm.
On to Star Wars Rebels. By the time this episode is out, the final episode of the first half of the third season of Rebels will have been out. And Matt's the only one of us who's seen it so far. I read some reviews of it. Let's just say it's super spoiler heavy. But we can't...
Heavy.
And I can't wait to hear you tell us everything about it, Matt. What we can say is that Gary Whitta, the one of the authors of Rogue One, we knew he had an episode of Rebels. It came out. Shockingly, it had no noticeable Rogue One tie-ins whatsoever. It was just another episode of Rebels. It was actually kind of like...
And a very, very overall insignificant one.
Yeah.
You know, just... Like, I don't think it's anything that's going to live on in any sort of way.
Which is really surprising. Very, very surprising.
Yeah. There was a really good gag with the door.
Yeah,
like that was a piece of good, you know, slapstick comedy type thing. But like, other than that, it's just wow! I can't believe that was the episode.
However, there wasn't the episode that followed it called An Inside Man, and that was a pretty phenomenal episode of Rebels, which we'll also be talking about behind the blast doors. But what I can say is that oh man, you want to see Thrawn ruthlessness and. Some death and destruction, and it's actually kind of shocking what they pulled off in this episode in some respects. So Rebels. If you're not watching Rebels, you got to watch Rebels. There's just some really fantastic stuff happening on that show. Are you guys ready to talk about Willow for just like a split second here?
Oh shit! Yes.
Okay, so, Willow Watch.
Willow.
Oh, boy. Our news for Willow Watch is that we have done our second all Willow Watch episode recording. We interviewed Alan Varney, the guy who wrote the Willow Source book, and we learned some things.
Mm-hmm.
They're not what we expected to learn, but they're very important things about Willow. and we are editing and assembling that episode and expect it to be out early next year, which is to say next month. So so not too long to wait. I'd spill all of it now, but where's the fun in that? Come on, Anthony Breznican gets to pretend like he doesn't know shit all the time. It's my turn now. however, there's a little bit of Warwick Davis fun news. We knew that he was in Rogue One, and now we know who he is in Rogue One. It turns out we've actually seen this character quite a bit. He's not a named person yet. A creature on Jedha firing a blaster. It's actually the first time he's fired a blaster in any of these films. And he can be seen in some trailers as well as in the creature featurette, which we'll link to it. The creature featurette is a great little featurette showcasing a lot of the awesome animatronics they have on set. And Warwick's character is featured pretty heavily in it. He's got some, for a character who seemingly is 100% in the background, it looks like a complicated lot of machinery up in that creature's face.
Hmm.
Thus ends Willow Watch. Now, in the world of Star Wars video games, Matt, how is Scarif?
it's gorgeous. I will say, because of the nature, like, kind of the same thing with Endor. Endor, to me, is the planet in Star Wars that really does the least as far as, like, making me feel like I'm on an alien world, because the vegetation is just so familiar.
Yeah.
The nice thing about going to a desert planet is it doesn't have vegetation issues, and same thing with Hoth. You know, obviously Bespin is very alien because, you know, we don't have cities in the clouds yet. And the Death Star is mechanical. But, and also others we didn't really spend a lot of time in. We didn't also spend Gunga? A lot of time on Yavin.
Huh? Come on.
But Scarif is clearly the Maldives, and which is where I'm pretty sure they filmed it. And so the trees are not, they're just earth trees. And so there's a lot of earth bushes and trees on the Scarif level that, for some reason, you can't run through like you can on the Endor levels of Battlefront. Like, they're kind of walls. But it's still gorgeous and amazing to see so much going on in the level, which makes me really excited about the Battle of Scarif. I guess that's the positive taken from all of this. And the Shore Troopers do blend in really well. But, yeah, it's fun. It's a neat addition to the Star Wars lore of environmental planets, but I have to say possibly the weakest.
Interesting. Well, that does end the Battlefront, I guess, releases. It's released. There's an Ultimate Edition that's either out or coming out for Battlefront. Scarif ends it. Or Scarif. Scarif. Scarif ends it. I've been saying it wrong in my head and out loud for so long. However, details on Battlefront 2 have started to come out, and we'd heard that there was going to be a single-player campaign, and yes, indeed, there is going to be a single-player campaign.
Nice.
DICE producer Paul Kelson said, "Myself as a Star Wars fan, I want story, I want narrative, I want something I can play that immerses me in that world, but gives me something to follow and chase." I agree 100%. That's why I didn't buy Battlefront. It looks so pretty, but there's nothing for me there. I don't really care about multiplayer games. He says the campaign has been locked in, and DICE has been learning on the job with its approach to the Rogue One and Death Star DLC. Also, J. Raymond's Motive Studios was announced to be working with DICE, and it's been revealed that their specific role is working on that campaign, which is super interesting because those guys are also working on Visceral Star Wars game.
Ooh.
Interesting. I think they're also learning a lot from Battlefield, which has had single-player campaigns in the past, but they weren't considered very good until this current one. So I think they've learned a lot, DICE overall. So I think we should be expecting a lot out of the Battlefront single-player campaign.
Awesome. Man, I can't wait. Oh, it's going to be so good. And I actually don't know when it's slated for. I don't know if that's out or if I just missed it. I do know Visceral's game isn't coming out until 2018, which is a long time to wait. I'll link to a clip. Games Radar did a great over-analysis of this really brief clip of a test version of their game that was shown off at E3 this year. And you see a character walking out of Mos Eisley Cantina. And it's during what looks to be a full Imperial occupation of Tatooine, implying that it takes place after A New Hope. So,
we may not have talked about this speculation, but now a lot of people think that that's probably Jeddah, not Tatooine. And that's due to Gareth Edwards mentioning that Jeddah was going to appear in a future piece of Star Wars media that he can't talk about.
Well, but the thing is that due to identifying objects surrounding the doorway, like it is definitively the cantina. That's the thing. Like, it has the same pod and rubble heap on both sides of the door.
So like, to see. Gotcha. Yeah.
And that's all gone over in great detail in Games Radar's video that we'll link to.
I just think that it could also take place before A New Hope, like maybe when the Empire first really landed hard on Tatooine, you know, to sort of shake everyone up, scare everyone. So then when they leave after that, they just leave a smaller sort of, I don't want to say fleet, but squadron behind, you know.
Have you seen this clip, Doug?
Like literally when they first released it, like a while back.
Because it's like, I mean, they've got two Star Destroyers like in the atmosphere.
Right.
They have Nazi style banners
stuff,
on.
Yeah.
I mean, that looks like when Lothal got occupied.
Right. But in the films, the way Luke reacts, it's like the Empire's been there for forever. It's not new to him. It's not like the Empire here. How? Why? You know, it's like it's just a fact of life that they're there, and no one's freaking out that there's a couple of stormtroopers walking through the streets, and there's only a handful of them. So it seems to me that Empire probably would have landed and hit hard, Blitzkrieg style, and then Tatooine's like, "Oh shit! All right, no, we give up. Just walk right in. No problem. Just come on in." And then afterwards, they pull out, leave behind several squads to patrol the streets, shake things up, and remind everyone who's in charge. But that's basically it.
Oh, that is entirely possible. That's very, very sound reasoning. So as far as the game, the new Visceral game, there's been a couple more details, such as the studio has been tweeting a lot of stuff about the Millennium Falcon and Han Solo and mention of scoundrels and so on, like kind of implying there's some kind of Han Solo connection. And it does happen to be coming out the same year as the movie. But they've already said that it's not a film tie-in.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there might still be some synergy there. Interesting detail to speculate on as, you know, time rolls on. We head towards 2018 when all that's actually going to go down. Meanwhile, another quick note is that a very interesting thing is happening. If you're ever curious about or loved the experience of playing Star Wars Galaxies, the first Star Wars MMO, there's a fan group that is launching a server. So you can play that experience as though the game was never taken offline.
And never changed from when it first premiered, like the original vanilla version before Sony decided to try and make it more like WoW.
Yeah, which is, I mean, this is a very important thing for a lot of people. And lots of people, like, the game was criticized quite a bit for being, like, rather dull. But it had a level of realism that no one had ever attempted before.
Mm-hmm.
And that realism involved, like, working a virtual job, which I admit, that's not for me. But maybe it's for you. Mm. And if you want to play it again, well, the Stella Bellum server is launching the same day as Rogue One, and we'll link to where you can get all the information on that on this episode's page.
And the big takeaway from that is not that, oh, you have to work a boring job, but rather you literally do what you want to do. Like, if you're like, you know what, I don't want to join the Empire or the Rebels. I just kind of want to be a bounty hunter. Well, then you just go and you just start doing it. And then while you're being a bounty hunter, you go, you know what? I'm tired of being a bounty hunter. I'm going to retire and be a musician and play in cantinas for money. You can literally do that. It's the freedom to move anywhere you want to go and do whatever you want to do. You could even say, all right, I've made a lot of money being a successful musician in a cantina. I'm going to start up my own settlement and eventually build it in my own town. And other player characters will start settling in your town and you'll be mayor. Or you could settle another town and convince the mayor he's no good, and then you can become mayor. Or you can move into a town and just start making these little villages crop up in the middle of the desert, in the middle of places, and player characters build things for each other. It's almost like a weird Star Wars commune, now that I think about it. It's like, but everyone starts helping each other out, and you start building things for other people, and you trade back and forth. And it wasn't exactly my cup of tea either, but it's, I think it's interesting that it's all these years later, fans are still so diehard about it. They're starting their own server, so I'm interested.
Yeah, more power to you guys. I think it's a great thing. Now we're wrapping up our pre-Blastors segments here, but first of all, like I mentioned earlier, State of the Empire and all the shows in the Nerdy Show Network are entirely listener supported. That means we rely 100% on you to make us possible. There's a lot of different ways you can contribute, such as one-time donations, supporting us on Patreon, or buying stuff on Amazon. With Amazon, you just follow our Amazon links, and anything you buy there, anything you add to your cart and purchase, that all contributes different percentages towards us. No extra money to you, but we receive some benefit. So consider turning all your Amazon links into our links, or following our links to specific Star Wars items on this episode's page. Meanwhile, over at Patreon, that's a monthly subscription service where you just decide how much money you'd like to give us a month for all of the content that we create for you. And in turn, there's a number of perks you can get, including a lot, and I mean a lot, of State of the Empire extra bonus features and outtakes and stuff. So you should do those things. We got links to details on all that stuff over at nerdyshow.com/support. Now, Matt, you had an experience at a 7-Eleven not so long ago.
That's a great way to start a conversation in a story.
not just a 7-Eleven, but like a 7-Eleven at like 2 a.m. I've been very lucky in that I live one block away from a 7-Eleven. And yes, I'm serious about that. I love that 7-Eleven. But right in the middle of the night, I ran into one of my neighbors, and they were mentioning to me how they've been watching, while unemployed, he's been watching Force Awakens on TV a lot. And then suddenly he just goes, you know what I realized? That movie is nothing but the original. And I'm like, oh yeah, no, it's definitely, like, it's got its, you know, similarities. And then all of a sudden the cashier at 7-Eleven was like, you know what, yeah, you're right. I've really decided I don't like that movie at all. And then all of a sudden, like, the guy at the other end of the 7-Eleven's like, yeah, man, Force Awakens wasn't that good. Like, all of a sudden, it became, like, 8 people at 2 a.m. in a 7-Eleven talking about how much they don't like The Force Awakens. And I would not say that I don't like The Force Awakens. That is not anywhere near that case. But I definitely am of the group that likes to criticize that movie for what it failed to do as far as being different. But, yeah, no, it was just a really surreal experience. Like, all these, and I can't describe how amazingly diverse the group was, of all of us coming together and finding some sort of bond over our feelings over The Force Awakens.
And your bond was hate, so, you know.
Yeah.
And this was in Los Angeles, in a pretty normal, like, what would say, mid-level part of Los Angeles. There was no high concentration of nerds at that particular environment.
Not at all. People from all kinds of walks of life, and I was definitely the nerdiest in there.
So,
well, actually, I am on a Star Wars podcast, and we talk about this exact thing. So please tune in here. I got flyers laying them out. It's like,
shit, man, just get your Slurpee and leave.
my double gulp, actually.
Double beer. But it is an interesting phenomenon. The fact that it's, you know, we could all enjoy it and like what was new about it and like what was familiar about it, but overall be just feel a little bit icky about how much was like pandering and way too similar, too close for comfort mm-hmm. to the original.
And just, you know, weird choices like Leia hugging Rey after Han's death instead of Chewie.
Yeah, fuck that.
As Chewie just goes to walk off to celebrate with the other resistance fighters, as if nothing's
maybe
happened.
It's in Wookiee culture to not, you have to mourn alone.
Oh, give me a break.
I don't freaking know. You tell me.
No, you sound like me now, offering you some weird EU explanation for why Chewie doesn't get a medal.
That's why I'm here, Spill. That's why I'm here. I gotta help make sense of this.
Hey, Matt, if we ever talk to Carrie Fisher, can you remember to ask her about that? Hey, did you ever think that, am I hugging the wrong person in this scene? Because surely she would have thought, I'm hugging the wrong person in this scene.
Unless, as people have said, like, Rey is a Solo, and that was just, you know, gonna go hug my daughter.
Yeah, maybe she felt it.
She just knew.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she's force sensitive.
Yeah.
And Rey's certainly force sensitive. So maybe they only then did they know.
Hmm.
Huh? You ever think about that?
Well,
only think about yourself and your selfish Chewie. Why is Chewie getting the shit end of the stick when it's really what he wants? Whatever. I'm done. I gotta bring it
we'll
in.
Talk more about Rey right now because we're gonna open these blast doors. So if this is where you leave us, we'll see you later. We've got all kinds of treats for you behind these blast doors, but I know it's tempting. Come to the dark side. Anyway, we're gonna open these blast doors,
don't you?
Oh, you've succumbed to the temptation. Welcome to the Blast Doors. Thanks for thanks for being here. All right. You know that creature featurette that I mentioned? Well, it's real good. And there's one scene where this dude is in...
We're in the big furry pants.
Yeah, the big furry pants for those white fuzzy dudes who actually show up in Dr. Aphra. Interesting inclusion of a species created for Rogue One in this new issue. But behind him is a full-size model and a bunch of sketches pertaining to a dude with a ventilator on his mouth missing all of his limbs.
Looks like he might be floating in a Bacta tank.
Yeah. Now, that's weird. That doesn't belong in Rogue One, because who's the first guest for that? Obviously, it's Darth Vader.
Well, Vader is in Rogue One.
He is in Rogue One. Gareth Edwards says he's only briefly in Rogue One. Mm-hmm. But jeez,
I hope he's just throwing us off.
What, that Gareth's throwing us off by saying he's only in it briefly?
Yeah.
And then again, how do you define briefly? Like, he shows up, like, are we talking like brief as in literally 30 seconds? Or briefly, like, there are several scenes of him, each one is about 10 seconds, therefore overall, like, I mean, think about it. The amount of times you see dinosaurs in the first Jurassic Park is like, what, 12 minutes?
Or Jin has a boss fight with him at the end, and that's the only time you see him.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing. Like, he's in it really briefly. Or it's like, yeah, briefly, like, what, 20 minutes straight, and then none at all for the rest of the movie? Like, that's not a good way of describing
But if we did see him in the film, why on earth would we see him in the film at with that level of vulnerability?
We still don't know. There are no other scenes in any of the trailers or TV spots released that harken back to the first teaser where someone in a robe is kneeling before what looks like a Bacta tank with red Imperial guards behind it. What the fuck?
I don't want to speculate on this. I mean, I do. I don't want this to be the truth.
Right.
But what if over the course of reshoots, that scene is no longer in this movie?
I would be relieved if there was a scene before where you saw a weak Vader in a tube and you saw him all, you know, emaciated and just like he was whatever. I Vader needs to be a ridiculously impenetrable threat. Like, as soon as you see that glimpse of him, you go, oh, he's only human. They can beat him if they just try hard enough, you know?
Well, I mean, I've there's been old EU things where, like, you know, it's Vader versus, like, 1,000 people. And, like, yeah, he's getting his ass handed to him because, like not his ass handed to him, but, like, he's taking damage. But he just keeps coming back.
Right.
And they're just blown off pieces. And then, yeah, he has to get healed at the end. Like, I mean, I've seen Vader torn apart in that way before. It's nothing new to me. It didn't make him less of a badass. If anything, it just made him like, holy God, holy shit, this guy doesn't quit.
But he's
like,
not.
The dark side is propelling him to finish off every single person.
But we're not seeing that. We're seeing an unconscious body floating in a Bacta tank.
Yeah, you don't know if it's unconscious. That might be how he chills when.
Yeah, sure. That's his spa trip. That was him at the Imperial spa.
Oh, Lord Vader, can I get you a mani pedi? Oh, I'm sorry.
I think you can absolutely
filter the margarita down through the tube.
if what he did was just tear apart like an entire rebel squadron or something, I think it still maintains his badassness.
Which is true. It's just it's weird that we would be exposed to the vulnerability of Darth Vader at exactly the time when he should just absolutely not have that kind of vulnerability.
Yeah.
That said, even though all signs 100% point to it being Vader, I suppose there's still a possibility that it's someone else who, as a casualty of war, becomes a quad amputee. Seems highly unlikely, but there you go. Or perhaps the possibility that it doesn't pertain to Rogue One at all. It just happens to be in the Creature Workshop happening simultaneously.
That's a huge coincidence, though.
It is.
I mean,
which is why I mention it with just as
yeah,
you know, here's a reason that we might be wrong. Here's an alternative.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the alternative, but
I think I'm with Spill on this, is that it might be something that is deleted. Like, it might have been part of a different entire sequence. Because then again, we never even figured out who is the possible person kneeling before the tank.
Yeah, that's a huge, like, thing. Like, what is that?
That whole scene, like, we haven't seen anything else like it, even close to like it.
Nope.
In any other thing regarding Rogue One at all.
And it's the thing that everyone has stopped talking about.
Yeah.
Like Imperial guards. Like, there's Imperial guards around the Bacta tank.
Yeah, what the fuck? Like, what? That would only suggest that the Emperor is there or close by.
Or that Vader uses Imperial Guards.
But why would he? He's Vader.
I don't know.
Unless that was my only thing. It was probably Vader in a Bacta tank. The Imperial Guards are surrounding the Bacta tank, protecting it. I mean, that's logical to me. I'm like, what are you going to do? You going to put TK-421 outside the Bacta tank where Vader's floating in it? No.
Maybe a Death Trooper. But
maybe.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Now, the character we mentioned earlier that was making an appearance is Grand Admiral Tarkin.
Grand Moff Tarkin.
Sorry, yes, Grand Moff Tarkin. Grand Admiral Thrawn, Grand Moff Tarkin. Grand Moff Tarkin.
Your head's still in Rebel space, man. Yeah. I get it, though. I get it.
We talked about them using new technology relating to what they'd done with Michael Douglas in Ant-Man and actually bringing an actor back from the dead in that respect for the first time ever. And we're fairly certain it's happening. There's, in the Anthony Brezikin article, he pointed to a TV spot called Breath.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, you see what appears to be an over-the-shoulder of Grand Moff Tarkin. I mean, I can't imagine it being anybody else.
Yeah, and Catalyst posited Tarkin and Krennic as being major political rivals to a point that I can't imagine a situation in which Rogue One would not feature that conflict.
Why are they at odds with each other?
It's basically a power struggle over who is in command of the project. Krennic comes from an engineering background, and he's sort of special weapons division and everything. And Tarkin himself is just he's always been an administrator. And they're both just currying favor as far as how they see. They both see the weapon differently, but for the same purpose. They see it as the way to really become the most powerful non-Emperor Imperial.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So they're constantly sabotaging each other's efforts very cleverly. And, Krennic actually manages to be very imposing as far as he's able to withstand Tarkin's. Peter Cushing just has a lot more as far as an actor. It's just a lot of gravitas to that role, and it would be hard for a new Imperial to come in and have that sort of thing for audiences, but Krennic, as shown in Catalyst, is able to hold his own,
and shown in some of the extended scenes and trailers that have shown up in the past week, he seems just a monster of a person. Someone you would under no circumstances want to fuck with. And this isn't just, a testament to the actor. He's just genuinely portraying this guy in a way that I think, oh my God, this is one of the most serious Imperials we've ever seen on screen. What else?
Yeah, he's a true believer.
What else have we learned from Catalyst?
Catalyst is great. It's not very action packed. It's just a very good character piece on Galen Erso and Lyra Erso, as far as just how someone could be conned into, legitimately, someone who just does not support the military and war, but at the same time can see the appeal of helping this project out. I mean, obviously, there's some duplicity involved in that, but all those people that have kind of speculated that Mads Mikkelsen's Galen Erso character is sort of this, scientist that ends up regretting what he does. It's not that he's going to regret it later. He regrets it now. He's against his will. So that's what we've kind of learned is it's not something that he went in with positive feelings about the Death Star. It's that he was tricked into it and basically has no choice.
Oh, man, I swear, if they go the route of Jin, this message is for you in case you would ever find me. I've left a small exhaust port open just in case. This is going to completely describe the entire plan of how to blow up the Death Star. It would be a little too... he intentionally designed this quote-unquote flaw.
Uh-huh.
Purely to be exploited like this. That I don't know. That might be a little too much.
Yeah, and the book did some other weird... a lot of very interesting things. They established that there's separatist holdouts that are still fighting post-Empire. Forming. So, there is some idea that there's separatist fleets that obviously aren't, the droid armies have been shut down, but separatist ships that are still fighting the Empire for at least a year or two after the Empire formed, which is kind of cool.
How does that
then
work
also
out?
That the corporate sector is forming, which was the region of space that Han Solo had his adventures in the old expanded universe, like the very like after Splinter of the Mind's Eye, after New Hope, like there was no other expanded universe until after Jedi was over, and those were the first books to come out, and they're the super pulpy ones that I hope that the Han Solo movie is like basing itself on, and that sector is forming. So it's a very weird like tidbit that it's not just like a mention. It plays into the last third of the book.
Which is pretty cool because, I mean, we've seen the sequence of expanded universe material teasing the future development of Star Wars like motion picture releases and television releases. So that it just makes sense. It just straight up makes sense.
Yeah, and it's a very, like, it's the corporate sector is something that hasn't really been talked about heavily since, I mean, the 80s. You know, like, it wasn't really a part of the 90s and 2000s expanded universe. It was just, you know, kind of part of yesteryear. So it's a very weird thing that they're reestablishing in a big way. And also, Catalyst featured a lot of information on Kyber crystals. Like, they're definitely living crystals. Ugh. The Jedi sort of bond that they have is very mystical, and it frustrates Galen Erso that it's something that he can't explain through science.
So, on that note, what about we've seen in a couple previews him giving a necklace to Jin. Is this going to play into anything, you think?
Possibly. Lyra is, she's very, so Galen's wife, Jin's mother, very much a force, like she respects Jedi and kind of like admires them in a way that's kind of similar to the way they've been describing Chirrut in Rogue One. So I wouldn't be surprised to find out later in life that Jyn Erso might be force sensitive and that might be her kyber crystal.
Little tiny, isn't it? For you know, it's a little necklace one, you know. Like,
oh, so you mean in Rogue Two, it's gonna be like Dark Forces Two, and she's gonna have a lightsaber in it.
Oh God, the Kyle Katarn comparisons are never gonna end.
I really don't like that. Like, did they just can't we just have a non lightsaber?
No. No, no, no!
Just a non lightsaber movie. Like,
she's gonna be Luke's first apprentice.
But older than him.
No, I'm sorry. She's a Knight of Ren.
Too old. She's too old to start the training. Yeah.
Oh, that's her in the Bacta tank.
Vader's like, yes, I want another quad amputee. I want to make a Bride of Frankenstein comparison. George Lucas would love this.
Oh, you know, man. Rise. He really would have.
Hey, so you've been talking about those Ursos a lot. We have an outline for the first scene of the film, which I'll share with everyone right now. This comes from the Mexico City screening, where a helpful individual basically posted a summary of everything he saw. He said, it starts with the "a long time ago" phrase, but then cuts to space, and we see Krennic's ship flying through the rings of a Saturn-like planet, and this is the flashback sequence. It starts basically in sequence. Mm-hmm. He compared it to Guardians of the Galaxy and how we see, you know, Star-Lord's origins on Earth and so on. So the Erso family knows that Krennic is headed towards them. They're trying to escape. Jin's mom has her hide and gives her a necklace and tells her that the Force will protect her or something along those lines. And then she goes out as Krennic and Dad Erso are having it out, Galen Erso, and she makes a stand. She shoots Krennic in the shoulder, but then she gets mowed down, and Galen gets captured, and the Death Troopers go looking for Jin, who is, and I love this part, saved by Saw Gerrera.
Hmm.
And then the title.
A friendship that began in Catalyst.
What do you awesome. Mean a friendship that began in Catalyst?
Saw Gerrera with the Ursos.
Oh, so they mentioned that before? Like that he knew Galen?
Well, they meet during Catalyst.
Oh.
Like they have a mutual friend, a smuggler, and eventually they kinda as Galen Erso is being more kind of forced into the project, like they sort of get involved in Saw Gerrera's sort of like one man fight against the Empire. It's not one man, but he's definitely his own network.
that's, I mean, and now we know why Saw has two haircuts in the film.
Possible explanation, yeah.
So then they went on to not show them exactly what happened next in the movie, but they did show a series of clips, including a scene where Cassian is introduced. He's escaping troopers in a big city, which this guy described as being prequel-like. So it might be someplace that we haven't actually seen featured heavily or at all in the trailers. Someplace that's more Coruscant-esque, which would be really cool.
Which, by the way, Pablo Hidalgo recently said that they are not done with Coruscant.
And why would they be? It's the seat of the Empire.
Yeah. I mean, that was an original George Lucas idea. I mean, he called it Imperial Center, but Coruscant was the name Timothy Zahn gave it, and George Lucas decided to keep it for the prequels.
We also see a scene where Jen is rescued from the prison, and they tell her they need her to get in touch with Saw Gerrera. Apparently, Bail Organa is in this scene. Jen rescues a little girl from explosions and hands her to her mom. And also, they saw an extended version of a scene with the scene they've shown a lot now of Chirrut and Baze Malba taking down the stormtroopers. However, what they saw that was extended is Chirrut mentioned that he is one of the Wills.
Which is crazy.
Now, Matt, what do you think that means in this context?
I think it just means, like, in this case, like, he's some sort of clergy member or something in this Church of the Force or whatever it is on Jedha. I gotta say, I doubt that this was George's original intention with the Wills, but if he could hear that and it's true and say that he loved this movie, I'm really encouraged, because it's like, this movie's actually like attacking like this sort of like internal headcanon that George Lucas had for like the origins of the Force and whatnot, and he was satisfied with what they had to say. So
it's been a lot. I mean, prior to the prequels, people thought Wills could have been Yoda's species.
Right, because we're just referencing, in case you're not familiar with this term, referencing the Journal of the Wills, which is allegedly the book that Star Wars actually is. And I say book with air quotes. It's R2 being the vessel for telling the story a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It's a whole late 70s George Lucas bunch of mythology that got swept under the rug big time.
Yeah, like the novelization for A New Hope that was like, you know, written by him but ghostwritten by somebody else starts with a quote from the Journal of the Wills. So it's like an in-universe tale of some sort.
And it would be interesting if Chirrut is of the Wills, and it could be like how there's books of the Bible and they're like the Book of John or whatever that was not written by him but was written by,
yeah,
like
Book of Luke.
The John enthusiasts.
The Book of Luke, Book of Anakin.
Right.
Book of R2. I believe passages R2-D2.
Is there anything else to discuss in regards to Catalyst, Matt?
Not that screaming to me at the top of my head.
Okay. Well then, let's go on to Rebels. Now, Inside Man, we see Grand Admiral Thrawn kill a dude. It's this, he's got some projects going on Lothal. And it's weird because we have a couple things revealed here. It's revealed that the new Fulcrum is, in fact, Kallus, which was, we highly suspected. And
which, by the way, I mean, I'm pretty sure it was on State of the Empire, but I'm sure before Rebels premiered, I predicted that Kallus would eventually defect.
I think you did. I think you did.
Well, what tipped it off to you in that sense?
It was when they announced him as a character. To me, it didn't seem, based on the Imperial agent from like Old Republic and that as sort of like an archetype of a Star Wars character, like I just had a feeling that it wasn't going to stay that way.
I was with Doug when he was watching the Antilles extraction for the first time, and that's where you hear Fulcrum's voice. And the Fulcrum's scrambled voice, like, listening to it a second time, because the first time I wasn't really like thinking of it in those contexts, but listening to it a second time, it's clearly the same voice actor as Kallus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's revealed, and he gives the Rebels an edge, but Thrawn lets plans be stolen in an attempt to find out where there's a mole, seemingly either knowing that it's Kallus or highly suspecting that it's Kallus. But the plans that he leaks them, some allegedly like secret thing, I was like, oh my gosh, what's it going to be? Is it going to be those TIE fighters that they use on Scarif or something pertaining to Rogue One? Because here we are at the mid-season break right in front of the movie. But it was something I could never have expected. And that was the plans for the TIE Defender, which is a starship from what game did it premiere in, Matt?
I want to say TIE Fighter. Might have been X-Wing. Definitely was in TIE Fighter.
Which, I mean, it's if you've ever seen it, you might think, the fuck is this fan creation? Because it's a TIE Fighter with three wings surrounding it. Basically, Defender being that it's got a lot of cushion before you get to its meaty insides.
Yeah, the fact that they actually mentioned that it's the first TIE with shields, I'm like, Jesus Christ, that's right. Like, in the old canon, that's accurate. Like, it was the first TIE with shields. And I mean, I think the TIE Advance, those have shields, but, like, nobody gets to fly them except, like, the Inquisitors and Vader. Yeah. But, like, for, like, a mass-produced starfighter, like, that was the big deal about them. They are defenders, quote-unquote.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that Thrawn leaks those plans on purpose. So it made me wonder, okay, is the Defender real? Is it something they drew up plans for and rejected, and they're just sending them down like a wild goose chase for something that's actually not, it's still not canon, it was just an idea, it never got made? It seems entirely possible, because as though the thing that Thrawn was actually developing in there was not leaked to the Rebels, and that's what he gave them instead. I'm not sure yet. I don't know that we'll know for a while now. But the series is going to return January 7th with a two-parter called Ghosts of Geonosis, which is fascinating sounding to begin with, especially for it's going to be a prequel lore loaded episode helping make all that make sense in the new reality of Star Wars. But before that, the episode Visions and Voices, which none of us have seen but Matt. So this is the next step in the ongoing saga of Darth Maul and Obi-Wan squaring off again. What happens?
Buy your tickets. This fight's happening. So just the quick summary, because a lot does happen. Ezra starts to hear and see Maul, you know, hallucinating. He sees him, like, within the Rebel base. He's having panic attacks. He all kinds of things. And eventually, Kanan takes him to go see Bendu to see what's wrong. Bendu tells him that during the holocron combination, they both received a little bit of what the other was looking for. So, you know, when Ezra was able to see, you know, a desert planet with twin suns, and Maul saw nothing but oblivion, which, you know, gives me a little concern. They were actually seeing what the other wanted.
Ezra Snoke.
Yeah. So Maul shows up because, like, I guess he learned where the Rebel base was based on having some of Ezra's thoughts from the holocron thing. And they both decide, all right, you know, let's go get this fixed. And so Ezra goes with him, and they go to Dathomir, which is Maul's home planet from Clone Wars, and is from the old Expanded Universe, and they twisted what the Night Sisters were and everything else, but it was very prominent in Clone Wars. And I feel bad for anyone who has never seen Clone Wars, because there's a lot of history here in the last, like, three seasons of Clone Wars, and what happened to Maul, and what happened to Asajj Ventress, and the Emperor betraying the Night Sisters, and Grievous, and everything else. It's all over the map. But Maul convinces Ezra to go under a, basically, let's finish the, you know, we'll do a old Night Sister ceremony with, like, essentially force magic. They're witches. Like, if you want to get an idea, for those that don't know who the Night Sisters are, think of the witch from the Ewok films. Like, she was a Night Sister.
Yeah, I love it. I love her so much.
So they do kind of a weird, you know, witch ceremony, complete their vision. And Ezra vocally identifies that he saw Obi-Wan Kenobi on a desert planet with twin suns, and Maul goes off to go find him. And Ezra sees him because he was looking for, the question he sought was how to defeat the Sith, and he saw Obi-Wan. So he tells Kanan, we need to find Obi-Wan Kenobi before Darth Maul does.
Can't wait.
Now, yeah. On top of that, which, by the way, I just want to bring everyone back to what we talked about a couple weeks ago with Ray Park talking about that promo photo of Maul and Obi-Wan fighting and saying that it was just a promo shot, but saying that it could be a hint of things to come.
Yeah.
Do you remember this?
Do you think they mo-capped him for this fight? Oh my God, Matt, they mo-capped him for this fight.
Maybe.
Holy shit.
Has Rebels like, or Clone Wars ever mo-capped anybody for anything before?
Nothing's been this important.
So, how would Ray Park be in on this? Like, he has nothing to do with the character other than public appearances. Like, I got to imagine he did something. And Sam Witwer is doing such an amazing job with his voice, I doubt they would replace him.
Oh, my God.
And also, Ray Park never did the voice for him anyway.
No, never.
So, you know, I don't know what's going on there. But, you know, there's something going on where he was obviously aware. Now, on top of that, in Clone Wars, Darth Maul came, like, eventually took Pre Vizsla, who was the Mandalorian leader that he worked with, like the sort of Mandalorian terrorist. Pre Vizsla had the Darksaber, which if you guys aren't familiar with, it's been a few things over the course of a long time, or a lot of Star Wars expanded universe, but it ended up being in Clone Wars a lightsaber that had a black blade that was very ancient and was apparently taken off of an ancient Jedi when a Mandalorian killed him. Darth Maul took that saber after he killed Pre Vizsla in Clone Wars. That was there on Dathomir, which makes it seem that's where Maul's been hiding out, that he's been keeping, like, basically living in Dathomir, and he has, like, a little lair. And by the end of this, Sabine takes the Darksaber, and they make a very big deal about her knowing what it is and her, like, almost like it's a birthright type thing. And really just brought me back to the sort of Obi-Wan, Duchess Satine, like, romance that they had going on in Clone Wars, where it seemed like they were former lovers, and then they had to, like, unlike Anakin and Padme, had to stop it, which is making me think that she might be related to Duchess Satine and or Obi-Wan in some way.
Sabine?
I know. Sabine. I know. Look, here's the thing. I'm not... When it comes to Star Wars theorizing, I'm totally, like, not... Okay, the best way I can put it is something that actually I read Pablo Hidalgo retweeted, like, yesterday, 2 days ago, something like that. Somebody had said, Star Wars theories and keeping them fun, Star Wars isn't inherently a M. Night Shyamalan-esque twist machine.
Right.
Like, it's had one crazy twist, and that was it, and it was done. Like... You know, Vader's Luke's father, no one saw it coming because the first movie didn't set up that there was some weird connection we had to figure out. It told us everything about, you know, who Anakin Skywalker was in the first movie. He was, you know, a Jedi Knight. He died. Darth Vader killed him. We moved on. Nobody was projecting in between episodes 4 and 5 that there was something weird going on. Now, Pablo Hidalgo retweets that. That means a lot to me. That means that when it comes to Force Awakens, that we're looking too hard into Rey's parentage, we're looking too hard into Snoke. However, to counter that, this is also sort of J.J. Abrams' fault because he did a weird flashback sequence without explanation. At least in A New Hope, Obi-Wan said what happened. He may have lied, but at least he said what happened. Force Awakens doesn't tell you any of it. So we're left with nothing to do but project. And... part of that projection of, like, or you know, guessing and theorizing is looking to other sources like Rebels. So what I see is Rey with a British accent, and Obi-Wan had a lover in Clone Wars, and all of a sudden Sabine, you know, she has some sort of thing with Clan Vizsla and the Darksaber, and that she might be related to Duchess Satine. What if... I hate doing this sort of theorizing. If eventually Sabine and Ezra have a child and it's Rey.
I've heard worse theories.
Yeah, no, I have too.
I wouldn't... let me put it this way. If that was the case, I wouldn't be as mad. Like, as if it was like some of the other things I've heard. I think that's a stretch.
Yeah.
But at least it's not terrible.
Because it would possibly make her a Kenobi as well. Because the other thing is, it disturbs me when I see that she's Kenobi's daughter. It's like, whoa, yeah. Our timelines are way off here because, yeah. Like, Kenobi's way too old by that point for it to be his daughter.
But if Kenobi unintentionally had, or unknowingly had Sabine, the dots connect well enough, but there's been such little emphasis placed on all of these other things, and I don't think they're going to risk the major main character of the next major Star Wars trilogy, where everyone wants to know who her parents are, and they're like, well, you got to see Star Wars Clone Wars episodes, season 3, episode 12,
From a, like, a creative person's standpoint, as far as that would mean, if this is true, Rey's parentage can't factor into the story of Force Awakens or of that trilogy at all. Like, it just has to be something. You know, like, she had parents, they abandoned her, and that was it. And so far, nothing has indicated that that's the case. You know, like, it seems like it's a big deal that her parents left her there.
Right.
So, yeah, you're right. As of now, I don't think that those dots are going to connect in that way. I think it is going to matter to the story at large. And I don't think it's going to be because, yeah, you got to go watch this arc of Clone Wars and then see how it resolves in this Darth Maul comic, in which, you know, he ends up with the Darksaber. And then Sabine finds it at the end, like the midway point of season 3 of Rebels. And then da-da-da-da-da-da. There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to somehow connect Kenobi to Rey, I think you do have a middle candidate now.
Mm-hmm.
Daisy Ridley said in a recent interview, in regards to the who her character's parents were, I thought a lot was answered in The Force Awakens. Then after the screening, I went for a drink with my agent and everyone, and we were chatting away, and I realized that, oh, in their minds, it's not answered at all.
Yeah, which sends me back to my original thought after seeing it, which was Han and Leia. I'm going back to my original thinking of it's Han and Leia, and they simply didn't know that she was alive. Because if it is, you're like, well, if it's Han and Leia, why'd they leave her behind? Great question. I don't know. If it was Luke, why did he leave her behind? I don't know. The only way I can see anyone intentionally leaving her on a planet for that long isolated is if Mom and Dad didn't know she was alive. How could they not know she was alive? Well, if Han and Leia are her parents and they send her off to train with Ben to go train with crazy Uncle Luke, and then shit hits the fan, she survives somehow, whether Kylo Ren kills her or thinks he kills her, or maybe just, I don't know, that part's unclear. But if Luke was like, oh shit, she's the only one who's alive, I can't give her back to her parents, I can't send her here, I can't send her there, I have to hide her until the time is right, that's the only explanation I can understand how,
you know. I just think her conscience is too clear during the Bloodline novel.
Yeah, Stephen Peckham on the Star Wars Spoilers Facebook group said, I want to believe she's Han and Leia's, but Bloodlines really contradicts that for me, because that book is set 6 years before The Force Awakens. Rey would be too old to be the little girl we're seeing dropped off on Jakku. Also, I believe wholeheartedly that the Knights of Ren section of the Force vision was a glimpse of Episode 8.
Yeah, but, you know, age don't mean shit in Star Wars. Look at Obi-Wan on Tatooine. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I don't know. It's also, I'm not, you know, there seems to be a lot of, you know, it seems to be a weird consensus that it was Luke that left her there. And there's no reason to think that.
I really don't know why Luke would have left her there. I think he would have done something better, like maybe just taken her with him. I don't know. The question is, who would leave Rey behind? I don't see Han and Leia leaving Rey behind for any reason, especially if Ben goes crazy and starts killing people. Why would they ever do that?
It doesn't make sense.
I mean, there's been a lot of speculation that, once again, you know, they set up a weird mystery, and part of Bloodline has been fixing the sort of weird timeline that we're presented with. Because, like, yeah, Rey's dropped off at a very young age, and 6 years before Force Awakens, Ben and Luke were okay. Like, it's only, you know, he's only been gone for 6 years. Actually, we don't even know how long. I mean, as of 6 years before Force Awakens, Ben was still kicking around with Luke. So we don't know when when exactly all the students and whatnot are dead. Bloodline doesn't even make mention of lots of Jedi. Maybe Luke just, he's only been training one person so far.
Eh, I mean, I don't know. And who? Okay, sure, maybe the thing was a flash forward, I don't know, but the only other theory that's out there is that if Ben and Rey are related, like brother and sister, if he's killing all the Jedi and he gets down to her and she's the last one and he doesn't have it in him to kill his sister, but he can't let Snoke know, Ben would leave her on a planet to die, knowing that he would never come back because he doesn't have it in his heart to kill her. He sends her away, tells everyone that she's dead. Snoke's like, oh, you killed your sister. Good job. You know, and like just kind of moves on. So later, yeah, Han Solo comes back into his life and he's like, would you have a problem killing your father, Han Solo? He means nothing to me. I can do it. So then Han Solo shows up. At the same time, a girl from Jakku has gone missing. He's like, what girl? Like, he wouldn't even imagine that she would have lived past age 10, you know, let mm-hmm. alone make it all this time. And now this girl is out there. I think there's something to that. But again, I didn't read Bloodline, so I don't know how the dates are supposed to match up, or if she was, if the timeline says Rey was abandoned before Ben turned to the dark side. I don't fucking know. I mean,
there's a lot of weird things. Plus, you have to take into account what's happening in the Aftermath books, which is in Aftermath, you find out that the Emperor visited Jakku 30 years before. Like, basically, he visited Jakku, like, during the heyday of the Empire with Mos Maeda and, like, a couple other Imperial officers and came across this child who is now the main bad guy in Aftermath. But basically gave him an assignment at some point saying, I need you to stay on Jakku because there's something that's been here for thousands of years and we're looking for it and it's very important to the Empire. And all of the entire Imperial fleet at the end of the second Aftermath book is currently going to Jakku, basically setting up the battle that, you know, right, will eventually destroy the Empire
right
completely. But like, what's the significance of this fucking planet? You know, like, and by the way, if you think that this series is got like the final book in that series, what finding out what's on Jakku comes out in February. So it's not like it's heavily tied into the next movie.
If Luke was supposed to be looking for the first Jedi temple, could it be that the first one was on Jakku and he's not trying to find it? He's trying to lead breadcrumbs to lead them away from it. Could explain why Lor-San Tekka is there.
It really could. It really, really could. To the Bloodline connection, not the book, but Rey's Bloodline, on the same discussion thread on Facebook, Seth J. Albano said, I would like to think she's connected to Kenobi, but I tend to lean towards Palpatine. It would explain a lot. Sean Peckham replied, Palpatine is my 10% sure theory. His interest in Jakku,
that's not very sure,
in Aftermath is way beyond coincidence, but I just love the idea that the Starkiller base duel would be a symbolic rematch for Vader and Obi-Wan.
I don't know. I think Rogue One will tell us a lot about how they feel about trying to incorporate prequel mythology into a story. How much they're willing to.
True, true.
That might be the difference between the writers of Rogue One and you know, Rian Johnson. I don't know how he feels about the prequels. Gareth Edwards strikes me as someone who can appreciate the world building that they did to the point where he's willing to include all these characters in his movie, potentially. If all of this is true.
Right.
Who knows? I mean, maybe she's same thing. Maybe she's created, you know, from the Force or some BS that.
We've discussed it before. I don't know, but you know,
we'll save our bets for before episode 8 comes out. Like the same way we were trying to take bets of whether Chewie would die or not. And I'm like, you guys are like, I don't know, is that fur or is that a bush in the background? I'm like, I don't know, dude, looks like a leather jacket to me. I think it's Finn. I think Finn's there. And you're like, I don't know, looks like brown fur. He's Chewie. You know, I don't know. And then, well, guess what happened? I'm just saying, I hate being right all the time.
I just want to take the Michael Eisner outlook to this, which is I don't know. It's a boot. Fuck it.
Yeah, fuck it. I don't know. It's not a spinoff. It's part of the continuity. So it's not a spinoff. It's a one off. No, it's not a one off because there might be a sequel. It's a spinoff, one off. I don't know. Fuck it. it's Rogue One.
Yeah, and it excites me to know that when you hear us talking about Star Wars again, we will have seen Rogue One And Matt may have seen it twice. You bastard.
Well, I'm also seeing a third time on that Sunday.
If it's good. What if it breaks your heart?
I have the tickets.
Yeah, regardless.
40X.
He's just gonna cry again. You have 40X tickets?
Like, Matt, why don't you tell the folks what you're going to be experiencing this next weekend?
Friday, I'm seeing it at the Chinese Theater IMAX, which is the tallest digital IMAX in the world. It's not the tallest because the 70mm ones are still taller, but largest digital. And it's probably the most amazing sound I've ever heard in a theater. But Saturday, I'm seeing it at the Cinerama Dome. And then Monday, I'm seeing it in 4DX.
Damn. Oh, I wish I could go to that.
Yeah, and 4DX is the Uber theme park ride version of, if you've ever seen a moving seat and it wasn't 4DX, that's a baby's toy. 4DX is the most insane.
You're basically going to see a two-hour version of Star Tours.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, not just that, but I mean, when like the AT-ATs like step into the water, they splash you with water, and I'm sure they're going to... The Force Awakens 4DX was terrific, and I'm expecting the same from this.
Yeah, now I don't condone seeing 4DX on a film you really want to see for the first time.
No,
but
no,
as your third viewing of Rogue One,
oh yeah, just get well done, better and better each time. Yeah.
Oh yeah, can't wait to fly with the next wing.
Well, thanks so much for listening to all this. post your theories in the meantime. We'll be commenting on them on the Star Wars Spoilers Facebook group. And, spread the love. If you dig Star Wars, you got friends who dig Star Wars, be sure to let them know about State of the Empire.
What if Rey, what if her parents are Vader and Dr. Aphra?
God damn it.
Just as valid. Just as valid. That's all I'm saying.
No, Dr. Aphra faked her death to get away from Darth Vader. He doesn't know she exists anymore.
I don't know. There could be. I sense a little bit of romance still in there somewhere.
There was never any romance in there.
I sense it in there somewhere.
Thanks so much for listening. Bye, I'm Cap.
Bye, I'm Doug.
Bye, I'm Matt.
All right, Doug, what's your dumb joke?
Where does a wampa keep his money? In a snowbank.
Fuck. No.
Nope. Oh, nope. Fuck.
Nope.
Fuck.
Nope.